It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome to Dig, a history podcast. Photography has been a way for people to remember people, places, and events. We commemorate and document life through photographs, and have been doing so since the 19th century. But photography has also been used to document death.
Today, we're going to be discussing Victorian postmortem photography. This has received a lot of interest on the internet lately, as Victorian memento mori photographs have become rather popular on certain internet sites. And although many of the pictures on these sites are in fact postmortem photographs, many are not. They're either completely fake or they're pictures of living people being passed off as postmortem photos. We're going to be discussing all this and more on this episode.
I'm Elizabeth Garner Masaryk.
And I'm Marissa Rhodes.
And we are your historians for this episode of Dig.
So there are many reasons to take postmortem photos, and we'll discuss a few of them here. One reason, and the one we'll be focusing on most today, is a simple human instinct to possess something of a loved one who's passed away. A way to mitigate death, so to speak. Now, to some modern-day people, it may seem strange to take pictures of people once they've passed away. And because there's a market for Victorian-era postmortem photography, we tend to think that Victorians were the only ones who took these kinds of photos. And so people think, oh, these weird Victorians are so melodramatic. And in some ways, yeah, they were, but, you know, we all have our quirks.
Right. So sometimes you'll hear people say things like, yeah, but Victorians were just so much more used to death. So these pictures weren't weird to them at all. And I say bullshit. Victorians mourned just as we mourn today. Just because death was more common doesn't mean that the pain and anguish that they experienced weren't as acute as it is today. So it might surprise some people to know that people still take postmortem photos of their loved ones. They are taken and they're kept in family photo albums and as personal keepsakes. The Victorians didn't display their postmortem photographs, say, on their mantle, just as people today don't display theirs on their mantle. The only reason these Victorian photos proliferate is because there is a market for them from collectors. But when they were taken, they were kept as personal keepsakes and weren't openly displayed. Instead, they would be stored in a locket, perhaps with a lock of the person's hair, or framed but kept somewhere private, like a bedroom or a family room. Or they might be small so as to keep in one's pocket.
And I want to say, I think that people's association with Victorians and mourning comes from Queen Victoria. And I think, like most biographers of Queen Victoria, and also in historical novels, historical fiction, mm-hmm. she's portrayed as someone who was in mourning for most of her life mm-hmm. because Albert died, you know, in the prime of life or whatever. She's portrayed as somebody who lived, you know, dressed in mourning and mm-hmm, mm-hmm. had a very mournful life. And so everyone just assumes, like, all Victorian, like, all people were just sure. in this dark cloak of mourning at all times. And it's not, like, really how
Sure. I mean, they did have stricter mourning customs than we do. I mean, like, you know, say during the Civil War, like a widow would have to be in mourning for an entire year, whereas a man would only have to be in mourning for 6 months or 3 months even. Was it six or three? I'm asking Sarah right now, who's the Civil War historian. Sorry. I'm pretty sure it's 6 months, but maybe it was three.
I know it was less than...
It was definitely less than a woman. A woman.
I'm not exactly sure how many months it was, but even women... You couldn't, it wasn't like your timer went off and then you were out of mourning. You had to go through the stages.
Yeah, you had high mourning where everything was black, and then you had like, I can't remember the second mid mourning where
it was like half mourning.
Yeah, half mourning.
You could wear like dark purples and lavenders and grays and stuff.
So it was a slow process. So, yes, Marissa, but no. You know, like, there were definitely like stronger rituals, but you're right. I mean, I think we tend to think of them as like over melodramatic or whatever, and this was just kind of
right
a part
and very
of
somber and everything. But there's, I mean, as you know,
I mean, I'm even thinking of Dorothea Dix. So she was a advocate for reforming mental institutions, and she wore black the rest of her life. Her husband died in the Civil War, and so she wore black every day.
Right, but that doesn't mean that she was, like, obsessed with macabre things or anything like that. Or that she, you know, was obsessed with death or anything. I mean, that's not what that means. That just
it means
that there's, you know, that it was kind of her symbol of affection for her dead husband.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, so my point is that I think that in popular culture, we think of Victorians and we think of, you know, death, sadness, sentimentality, macabre sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
And
sentiment, yes, but maybe the macabre not so much.
Yeah, maybe not so much. Yeah, so there may have been a stronger impulse to keep death in mind, to retain the presence of a loved one by, say, having a piece of jewelry like a watch, chain, or a bracelet made out of your deceased loved one's hair. So, yes, in this way, Victorians tended to keep reminders of death on their person more so than we might today. Today, the tendency is very much to separate ourselves from death, to keep it out of mind. Most people have not seen a dead body, let alone touch one. And yet, flip on any television channel, even the non-cable ones, and I guarantee you, within a few clicks, you'll find a true crime show complete with a realistic-looking dead body. So... you know, are we really all that different? We pushed at the way, and yet we pine after it in the media that we consume.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'll take the sweet sentimentality of Victorian mourning any day over current news or cable shows, as I know you love them, but I can't stand them.
Well, no, you're talking about, there's a difference between dramas and true crimes.
Okay. I guess.
Okay. Yeah. Damn it.
All right. So even though it may seem strange to some people, these taking pictures of deceased people, you know, to others nowadays, it won't seem strange at all. People still take pictures of their loved ones. My family is one of them. I've read in various places that this may be a Southern thing, but I don't think that's true. And I actually went down the street and asked a funeral director here in Buffalo if people still take pictures at their funeral home. And he said, yeah, absolutely.
Wow, gumshoe detective.
Well, literally, there are three funeral homes on my street.
That's depressing.
So I just popped my head in because,
I'm just coming in to ask. So I'm assuming that people are taking photographs of, like, embalmed...
Yeah,
prepared corpses,
prepared in the casket with the flowers all around. Mm. You know, so it's a setup.
So it is like Victorian, like, well, where they're like very much.
Your family didn't post. I mean, I have pictures of like my loved ones in caskets.
Yeah, we don't do casket. We don't do open caskets. But I was jumping in to say, you said people still do this. I remember very clearly my mom and I both, it was before my dad passed away, but when he was in his final hours. Taking pictures of like his hands, you know, I didn't want to take a picture of his face because he looked so different, but I was like, I need to remember like the contours of his hands, you know? So I have them I look back at them and they kind of make me a little nauseous. You know what I mean? But at least I have them. So I can understand the sentiment even today.
Well, I have a lot of pictures of me with my father on his deathbed.
Right.
And you know, he has all these like tubes and things. It's not great, but there's pictures of me like cuddling with him on his, you know, hospital bed and things like that. And I was going to do that whether they took pictures of it or not, but I you know, it's kind of nice to look back in a gross way. Like, it makes me sad. But I'm also glad that I have
that. Yeah, it's like a touchstone, right? Yes. Even if it makes you kind of, like, those pictures for me make me really gross, make me feel really gross, and I don't look at them ever. But they're there if I ever need them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, just in case I need them.
And I think that goes back to the thing about, you know, we see these things for sale on eBay and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we think that, like, oh, those Victorians are so weird. They had these photos. And it's like, no, these weren't plastered all over their wall.
Yeah, they
like,
were commercialized.
They were private things just today as we have these pictures that we're just talking about. Like, they're
maybe,
not on
okay,
our mantle.
Maybe a more palatable way of understanding this, I have an example for. So my friend passed away 2 years ago from cancer, and her husband knew that we would want something of hers, like something to remember her by, just something to remind us of her. So he had an artist come in and make these like little, I don't know, epoxy looking like gemstone things. And they put her fingerprint in them. So I have like this little kind of gemstone with her fingerprint in it. And then it has like a little metal thing attached to it with a heart that like says something like thank you or, you know, something like that. So I have this special little keepsake in a box. And, you know, after it happened, I said thank you so much to her husband for that. And he said, well, I hope this doesn't freak you out, but she had already passed away when we took that fingerprint. And I was like, no, that's fine. You know, he said that because he knew that I would. That's yeah, that could be weird to some people. But yeah. I personally, you know, really liked that I have something left of her body, sort of.
Mm-hmm. It's a physical. It's more than just the remembrance. So you have a physical thing that can help jog memories.
Right, right. And that may seem less weird to somebody than, I don't know, than a photograph or a lock of hair, which admittedly seems strange. So another reason to take postmortem pictures is to prove that, yes, in fact, a person is dead. A good example of this can be taken from our previous episode about guerrilla warfare and the Civil War. We have an image of Bloody Bill Anderson on that blog post, and he's pretty obviously dead. So it was our way for authorities to show that, like, see, we got him. They did the same recently for Osama bin Laden, although they didn't release that picture to the general public, so we just have to kind of trust them on that one. But the Bush administration did release photos and videos of Saddam Hussein's hanging, as well as postmortem pictures of his sons Uday and Qusay after they were killed by Delta Force. So again, we see the Wild Wild West pictures of dead criminals like Billy the Kid and Bloody Bill Anderson, but the practice isn't really all that foreign.
A third reason for postmortem pictures is part of the death record at the coroner or the medical examiner's office. Now, this is going to vary a bit by, you know, county by county and state by state. But generally, if somebody dies without an admittance to a hospital within 24 hours, an autopsy is performed on that person. Since that is done through the state or county level, they will take photos of the deceased as part of that medical record or medical journal. So not everyone will have these photos taken, but a lot will.
So back to our discussion of Victorian postmortem photographs. These are also referred to as memento mori. Memento mori dates back to classical times. It translates from Latin, remember that you have to die, which is sad. So it's a reflection on your mortality, basically. It can be depicted in art, literature, whatever, and varied from the classical period to the modern era. In the 19th century, it took on a form of sentimentality. So people could commission trinkets made from the hair of their loved ones, or they might carry a locket with the photo of a deceased loved one with them.
Now, we mentioned earlier that Victorians felt death as we feel today. So don't forget that the Victorians weren't living that long ago. So like the way I think about it, my grandmother, who I was really, really close to, died at the age of 96. Her mother was a Victorian. Right. So that means like our parents or perhaps our grandparents were grew up and were, you know, intimately familiar with people who grew up during the Victorian era. So it's just kind of a reminder to remember that like the 19th century wasn't that long ago. Like when we kind of think about, oh, those crazy Victorians and the crazy things they did, like it wasn't that long ago when you think about it.
Right. And I do the 18th century and I think of that with the 18th century as well. I can see some people born in the 18th century, especially later on, who died at a time when my grandmother was alive.
Right.
Or what, I mean, it's like crazy. I had a really old grandmother because my dad was really old, but no, probably not everyone can say that. But yeah. You know what I'm saying?
No, it's I get weird. It. I mean, my family's there's old too. Like parent, all the women have had their children in their 30s,
right? Like so, later, yeah. So, and my dad was 50 when I was born, so right. Everyone's like right, old. Right. So, yeah. It's just that's fascinating to me. But of course, there were aspects that were different. One thing that Victorians prized was something called the good death. And we've alluded to this in a few of our other episodes, I think particularly on our episode on the rural cemetery movement with Sarah and Elizabeth. Essentially, the good death was a peaceful, natural death at home. One was surrounded by family members and loved ones. It wasn't violent and there was no overt suffering, just a sort of gentle slipping away from this world to the afterlife.
Much of the ideology surrounding how this perfect death would play out had to do with the disease tuberculosis. We also discussed this in detail in our Tuberculian Chic episode, and we'll link to that episode and the rural cemetery episode in the show notes, or just search our podcast feed. Now, tuberculosis is actually a horrendous way to die because the bacteria can, it creates pockets or cavities in the lungs, which can become infected with other bacteria, and that forms pockets of pus, and these damaged areas can cause bleeding. So basically, it starts to cause holes in the lungs and the airways, which understandably makes it very hard to breathe. Before antibiotics, people with TB, essentially, they just wasted away, becoming pale and thin before finally dying of what was then known as consumption. The disease profoundly shaped beauty standards in the 19th century because effects of the disease actually highlighted aspects that people already found beautiful, such as being thin, having very pale skin, or having rosy lips and rosy cheeks due to a low-grade fever.
And shiny eyes.
And shiny eyes, yeah.
Yeah. But this wasting away was what exemplified the good death. The good death was not a public event. It was an extremely private one, restricted to the closest circles of the dying person. And not all good deaths were the result of TB. That disease just happened to be the pinnacle of the good death. So if you had TB, you had this sort of romanticized death.
Mm-hmm.
There are many literary depictions of the good death as well as many paintings. But since this is a podcast, we'll read you one from the 1852 novel Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Okay, you ready for a dramatic reading?
Yes.
The child lay panting on her pillows as one exhausted, the large clear eyes rolled up and fixed. Ah, what said those eyes that spoke so much of heaven? Earth was past, an earthly pain, but so solemn, so mysterious was the triumphant brightness of that face, that it checked even the sobs of sorrow. They pressed around her in breathless silence. Eva, said St. Clair gently. She did not hear. Oh, Eva, tell us what you see. What is it? Said her father. A bright and glorious smile passed over her face, and she said, brokenly, Oh, love, joy, peace, gave one sigh, and passed from death into life. Farewell, beloved child. The bright eternal doors have closed after thee. We shall see thy sweet face no more. Oh, woe for them who watch thy entrance into heaven, when they shall wake and find only the cold gray sky of daily life, and thou gone forever.
Hooray! I would clap, but I'm holding my phone. So, a little bit melodramatic, but also you see the peace in it. Eva was sick, but in that deathbed moment, she turned her eyes to heaven and peace is upon her, and she slips away surrounded by loved ones. There are very few photos of deathbed scenes. These were mostly captured in paintings and illustrations.
One very famous image of the deathbed scene is an 1858 staged picture of a girl near death in the presence of her family called Fading Away. It was created by English photographer Henry Peach Robinson. It was...
Sorry. It's a...
What, Peach? It's funny. Henry Princess Peach Robinson.
Okay.
All right. It was created by English photographer Henry Peach Robinson and was published in America as a woodcut reproduction the following year. We'll post the picture on the blog, but for any of you who are familiar with the Good Death, this is probably the picture you've seen. What's interesting, however, is that the photographer actually got a lot of flack in England when he created this photograph because people felt like it was vile, a gross intrusion upon a private scene. This was supposed to be an intimate familial event, not one visible for the entire world.
But many Victorian postmortem photos still fall within that framework. Because in those photos, the person's normally depicted in a state of sleep, looking perfectly restful, like they might wake up at any moment.
Postmortem photography, or taking photographs of people after death, became more popular as the medium of photography grew and became cheaper and easier to produce. These photographs were performed as one of the services that a professional portrait photographer would do. Like portraiture, it was at first accomplished almost exclusively by the daguerreotype process.
The daguerreotype was a small, highly detailed picture on polished silver. When it was first invented and introduced as a consumer good, it was an expensive luxury item that only the wealthy could afford. This quickly changed, however, throughout the 1840s as the number of photographers increased and the cost of daguerreotypes decreased. Cheaper modes of photography were introduced in the 1850s, as well as other forms of portraiture like the ambrotype, which was on glass, and the tin type, which was, get this, printed on tin, cheap metal. Yeah, and photographs also started being printed on paper in the 1850s as well. By the 1860s, most everybody was able to afford portrait photography at one point or another.
Right, so this gets us into some of the myths surrounding Victorian postmortem photography. Because let me tell you, there are some whoppers about these pictures out there on the web. I don't know, I'm a goth, right? So I've been seeing these pictures like on the interwebs for a while now. But, you know, if you're not familiar with these, just a quick Google search of Victorian mourning photos or something like that will easily get you into the rabbit hole. But we are now going to put on our professor hats and be buzzkills and kind of slay some of these myths now, okay?
All right, so let's take, for example, the standing corpse photo. So this is a staple of postmortem hoax sites, and there'll usually be, you know, a bunch of children, and one of them looks kind of wonky, like, you know, her eyes rolled back into her head or something like that, but she's standing up just like the rest of the kids. So there will always be someone who says, hey, you can, you know, you can see there's a stand at her feet. That means that she's dead. But the family just had to get a photo of her, so they're all just like pretending that mm-hmm. she's not dead.
Right.
But, you know, that's wrong. Usually that picture is just of a little kid who's acting like a little kid. And, you know, if you go through my iPhone, you can see, you know, I have to take probably 10, 12, 15 photos to get one photo where both my kids' eyes are open and they don't look like they're, you know,
zombies.
Yeah, basically. So that stand that you see that's visible in the background, it's literally just there to keep a squirmy kid from squirming all around.
Right.
And it obviously didn't work because a lot of times these little kids are messing up their family photos anyway.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's, I'm thinking of this one article. It's like, it's actually on the BBC website. Talking about these postmortem photos. And it is. It's of four children. The littlest girl is standing there. Her eyes are rolled back. And they're claiming this is a postmortem. So this is a fairly common picture when you know, that we're explaining right now and that you see on these hoax sites. And no, it's just little Missy's acting like a kid. So, and one of the reasons that this can happen is, you know, at this time, photography, although we mentioned how it was, you know, moving and progressing quite along, it was still in its early stages, and it was a very tedious ordeal. The camera shutter had to stay open for a very long time, sometimes up to 30 minutes, to get a clear shot. So this is why you see a lot of blurry old-timey photos. If people move just in the slightest, you know, they took a deep breath, moved their head a little bit, the portrait was ruined. And sometimes the photographer wouldn't even know that the portrait was ruined until the film would, was developed.
Right. So at that point, he's just like, well screw it.
Whatever. Done. That person's gone home now.
Right. So many photographers held people in place with a variety of stands, braces, and clamps. There's plenty of photographic evidence of these things being used on very alive people. They were simply to help people stay in the position that were needed. They were needed to stay in for a long time. I mean, if you think about it, it would be really hard to just sit completely straight, especially if there's, like, you have your kids around you and stuff. I just can't even imagine how you could do that.
So that's one of the reasons why nobody is smiling in these old, you know, photographs. I mean, think of it, like, right now. You can't smile that long. Try to hold a smile for the same smile for 30 minutes and not look like a weirdo. Like, it's not going to happen.
No, yeah.
So that's why nobody's smiling. It's also a reason why a lot of people look dead. It's because they are literally bored to death. You're just sitting there staring at a box for, like, ever. You know, they have to be perfectly still. And so that stillness translates onto film as a stiff, lifeless body.
Right. And I swear that I have read an article about this, about people perceiving Victorian portraiture as representative of Victorian life.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that everybody was so serious and nobody did anything fun and everyone was sad all the time. Because in these photographs, they look like, you know, fucking life. Right. But really, it's just
because they were bored to death because they were having to sit there and not move. And,
it's just a symptom of what photography was like at the time.
Exactly.
Right.
But no, say the internet hoaxers. Like, here's another example. Okay, so I'm going to explain to you this other picture that a lot of people, circulate. It's one of two teenage girls. One girl is sitting, one is standing. And the standing girl, she looks very pretty, but what's going on with her hands? Look at her hands. And they are in a very weird, unnatural position. And look closely. They are darker than the rest of her skin. See, this proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that she's dead. And then, you know, people go into this long discussion about how when a body is deceased, gravity forces the blood to pool in the lowest points, yada, yada, yada. And it all sounds really good and fine. It starts to make sense, but it's not true. The girl in the picture is very much alive. Sorry, no dead body looks that fresh. Her hands are normal. Yeah, maybe not in the most natural of positions, but they're normal. The discoloration that you squinted so hard to see, it's only lighting. Remember, this is a black and white photo. But then they'll say, but wait, there's a visible brace in this one too. See, right there by her feet. That proves she's dead, right? Nope, sorry. It just proves that she had to stand for a super long time to get this photo, and the stand is helping her stay still. And she's really pretty in this picture, so I really doubt if she'd appreciate people claiming now
that she's dead.
Because she's,
because this is the important part. This girl's vanity. But here's the nuts and bolts behind why the myth of the standing Victorian corpse photo is implausible. So first, a dead body is heavy, and gravity is literally working against it. Think about this. If there's no muscles firing in a body, think about the muscles of the face, particularly jaw muscles. When we're alive, we're firing our facial muscles constantly in order to keep our jaw shut. If we weren't, we would literally be walking around with our mouths just gaping open. Yeah.
Yeah. So real world example here, I used to work at the morgue, and when I worked at the morgue, that was always the thing that was most, disturbing about decedents. Even laying flat in a prone position, the jaw just does something weird when the body is deceased. It doesn't sit or hang naturally. The lips are parted in a way that isn't visually appealing. Like when you read something that says her lips were parted, you think, ooh, sexy. But no, this is disturbingly parted.
It's really disturbing.
Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, it's a strange
very
thing.
Clear.
Okay, yeah. And usually the teeth are visible. So it's hard to describe. It's like once one of those things, it's like the smell. It's a sickly sweet smell. And so once you've seen these things and smelled these things, like, you instantly know that it's death. Right.
Yeah.
So they're hard to describe, but
and
they're
part of that facial expression is like, you know, that it's a movement of the mouth, or it's like what a face would look like. And you know that a person would never want their face to look like
right.
You know, no one's ever holding their face like that on purpose.
Right.
And you know, everyone does a mirror face, you know, so when you're in front of a mirror, you like
with
do a face. Yeah. You do some kind of face. And then, you know, if you're just walking around and you accidentally come in front of a mirror, you don't expect. You're like, shit, that's me, because you aren't used to it, because it's not your mirror face. You weren't prepared. But that's how you know, nobody would ever do that on purpose. So in these pictures, if the standing person were deceased, there would have been something around the person's face holding the jaw up. Otherwise, they were just standing there with their jaw gaping open. You know, I think they use glue a lot on the lips to actually keep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Then their lips and look stretched or whatever.
Right. And that's just one example. I mean, the neck wouldn't hold up. Like, nothing. Right. It's literally a rag doll.
Exactly. So, yeah.
But, you know, your internet hoaxer will say, okay, but what about rigor mortis, right? That's what is keeping this person upright. Fair enough.
Rigor mortis sets in 2 to 6 hours after death, and it takes about 6 to 12 hours to spread throughout the whole body. So from there, it can last another 8 to 18 hours. All of this really depends on the person's physiology, their age, sex, health, probably in the environment where their body is, all kinds of things.
Yeah, and it's been a while since I worked at the morgue, so I was kind of double-checking myself when I was making this copy. I wanted to make sure that I had my timing right, correct. And I found a couple of sources that say rigor could last from 1 to 4 days. I personally don't know about that. I guess maybe under certain circumstances that might be true. I have personally worked with hundreds of decedents and have never had anyone in rigor for that long, so I don't know. But once a body is in full rigor mortis, they are really stuck, right? So one of my jobs at the morgue was to prep decedents for autopsy, and that meant that I had to undress them. If a body was in full rigor, I would have to, quote, break the rigor to move arms, legs, or whatever to get them undressed. Now, I didn't actually break their bones or anything like that, but it definitely took some muscle on my part to move them. Massaging could help, but it also required some really manual force. And I don't want to be crass here. This was always done with the utmost respect. I don't want anybody freaking out about a loved one going and having an autopsy or anything. I'm just saying this so you know it is a very hard, being in rigor, especially full rigor, is really hard. It feels like they're solid.
So we're telling you this just to show that in rigor, the muscles are hard and stuck, which is... which theoretically could make the standing corpse photo work. But in reality, most people don't die with their arms and legs in perfect position to look normal while standing. You may have an arm sticking straight out, or your knees may be slightly bent, etc. And not to mention, those little stands that you sometimes see peeking out of those photos, they're way too small to hold up a completely dead weight of 100 pounds or more.
Right. So sometimes decedents were photographed standing up, but that was done almost exclusively by law enforcement, right? So if you see a postmortem photograph of somebody standing with a stand, more than likely that person is alive. Let's just say that. But there were obviously pictures of people standing up. Those would be taken by law enforcement. In those cases, a body would be strapped into a special chair or against like a cooling board. And so that type of photograph would be taken like by forensic photographers or perhaps newspaper photographers, to prove that like a criminal is dead or something.
Oh, okay.
Like that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And in case you're still not convinced, scholars have scoured photographers' notes and papers in the 19th century about, and they've looked into how they've conducted their photography businesses. So here's Jay Ruby, an expert on Victorian postmortem photography. He found that none of his sources included posing the dead to appear standing or in a, quote, just hanging out kind of pose. Instead, he found that a picture of the deathbed was popular. If the family was included, sometimes photographers created a good death scene with the family displaying subtle grief.
One photographer wrote in 1873, "When I began to take pictures 20 or 30 years ago, I had to make pictures of the dead. We had to go out then more than we do now, and this is a matter that is not easy to manage, but if you work carefully over the various difficulties, you will learn very soon how to take pictures of dead bodies, arranging them just as you please. The way I did was just to have them dressed and laid on the sofa, just lay them down as if they were in a sleep." So Jay Ruby found no examples or evidence of photographers posing or moving dead bodies to make them look alive.
Now, there are a few instances where bodies are made to look alive, but these are rare and not very convincing. There are a few instances of eyes being painted either on the body itself or on the photograph after development, but these are very rare and far between and aren't very convincing. In fact, these may have more to do with certain ethnic cultural practices than an example of Victorian culture as a whole.
And just a couple of other myths to address. This other one is called the Invisible or Hidden Mother. And these are pictures of children, live children, who are sitting on what looks to be a person covered with a sheet. And that is exactly what these pictures are. So remember how long we said the shutter speed was, right? Could be up to 30 minutes. If you've ever been around a child, you know that they don't sit still for 30 minutes. So one way to get a picture of your little crumb snatcher was to sit down, get covered with a sheet, and act like a chair, and then have your little darling sit in your lap while the picture was taken. So the presumably mom, could have been the dad, I guess, is there. You know, she makes the kid feel safe, but she's also holding them or bracing them. These pictures are funny, and some are done better than others. Some, the mom is literally holding the kid's head, like, on either side, like, facing his head forward. I've seen another one where a child is standing on a pedestal, and, like, somebody is literally standing behind a curtain holding the kid's head straight, so you just see these arms, like, reaching
That's
out.
Fucking creepy.
They're so funny.
So sometimes... these pictures circulate and people say, oh, see, that mom's actually dead. And this picture is showing that the kid's mom is dead. Or that these pictures are the memento mori because they're showing that death can come any minute. And that's why mom or dad, I guess, you can't really tell, is covered up. It's symbolism. Creepy. Nope. Not really. It was just a cheap way to get squirmy kids to sit for a photograph, and some photographers pulled it off better than others.
Yeah.
Some of them are really well done, and you can hardly tell. Like, it's pretty hard to tell that there's a human, like, mm-hmm. behind.
Yeah, some of them, like, you really, yeah, they do. They look like a big armchair or something.
And yeah, so you can see what they're going for. Yeah.
And then other ones, it looks like somebody playing Halloween ghost dress up.
Right.
But we have some examples on the blog as well, so check that out. Another myth floating around is that photography was so expensive that people would only photograph their relatives after they were dead. And this wasn't the case. As mentioned previously, photography became less and less expensive as the century wore on. So in some instances, this may have been true early in the century. It definitely wasn't so later in the century. Most people probably had a picture of their loved one living and dead by the 1870s or later.
Most Victorian postmodern photography displays the decedent as sleeping or lying restfully. Some are in a couch or a bed. Oftentimes children are in a small coffin, and many are surrounded by flowers. Remember, these were taken as a way to hold on to the memory of someone special who had died. So no matter how much creepiness we ascribe to them now, these pictures are full of love and sentimental sadness, and they were perceived as such at the time.
Right. A quick eBay search will show you that there is a strong market for these photos, and apparently no shortage of them for sale. Many of the photos aren't really postmortem. I did a quick search before this. I saw one on eBay of a little girl playing with a doll. She's obviously sitting up and playing, but her eyes were shut, and therefore the seller was calling her dead. But there are also a lot of real ones on eBay, too. The collecting of these types of photos has exploded since the advent of the internet. The Thanatos Archive, which houses about 2,000 of these pictures, will let you look at them for a subscription fee. The Burns Archive is another private collection, which houses some postmortem photography as well.
So yes, Victorian postmortem photography was a very real and special thing. And there are plenty of legitimate and sentimental postmortem photographs to be found. We just want to remind you that Victorians weren't that different from us, really. And I have to say that, you know, this sort of thing has never really creeped me out. I know I have some friends who are in the business of taking photographs and making art for stillborn babies. Mm-hmm. And I know that there is kind of a big market out there, not for random people, but for families who have a stillborn child or a child who dies shortly after birth. They'll have a photographer come and take mm-hmm. pictures of them holding the baby, things like that. And when you think of it that way, it makes perfect sense. I mean, if you think of a modern person, you wouldn't think it was that weird if somebody wanted pictures with their mm-hmm. deceased child. You would think, oh, that's so sad. And I understand they want that memory. But that's because they're modern people. But when we look back and Victorians are doing it, there's automatically something weird about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think part of that is just an artifact of how weird or how hard it was to take photographs at the time. standing there like this, and it's because of how hard it was. Right. So photographs, just old photographs, just look creepy.
Right.
In general.
Right.
Even if the photograph, a photograph of the same thing
today would, right. No, I hear what you're saying. Yeah. So my, what would she have been? She was my grandmother's sister. So I guess like my great aunt. She had one of those old box cameras, like, and she took a family portrait of us one time with it. And so it was a, I don't know, like a 7x7 box, essentially. It had a little hole on the front and she was looking inside, and we had to stand outside because it was the only place bright enough. And we literally had to stand there for like 10 minutes while she took this picture.
Oh my gosh.
And I remember, and I was like maybe 7. I just remember like, oh my God, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. Like, I don't know. And I remember they got it, you know, they got the film done, and yeah, we were all just like completely blurry. Cause I mean, even the grown-ups, you know, looked weird cause everybody's just standing there. And so,
well, it makes you think, like, how are we going to be perceived, you know, a couple hundred years from now?
Oh, totally weird.
Based on our photographs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, people will be like, yeah, why did this person take a picture with their Pizza Hut? Yeah. That must have been a sacred activity.
Yeah.
It's like, this chick just wanted you to see her lunch.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah. It just makes me wonder about that, you know?
Absolutely.
And I also, I don't personally think it's that strange to photograph dead loved ones. I think if you really love someone, it's really hard to let them go, to mm-hmm. let their body go even.
Yeah.
Even though you know that it's not quite them, it's just their remains. It's just really hard.
It's remembrance.
Yeah, exactly. And I totally understand. And I'm one of those weirdos who would totally love to be cremated and then have my ashes turned into a diamond.
My kids wear. Yes.
That seems badass.
Totally.
Most people think that's the most bizarre thing, but I totally get it.
Mm-hmm.
Or people, sometimes people's ashes are put underneath a tree and then a tree is planted on top of them. Mm-hmm. And they kind of like, you know, their bodies are brought back to life.
I'm going to be donated to the body farm.
What?
In San Marcos.
So you're just going to rot away in some forest somewhere?
Yes. Well, grad students poke at me.
Sounds like a dignified end.
To be dissected?
Yeah, or they, you know, do different things to see how the body does in certain environments or whatever, so that they can teach people who are doing autopsies and forensic anthropologists and all that kind of jazz. They need to learn.
Yeah, they need to learn. That's true. But it is so strange to think when you know the person.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Well, on that note, thank you for listening.
Yeah, please, on that cheery note.
Yeah, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Subscribing is completely free, and it will mean that you will never miss an episode. And while you're there, leave us a review while you're at it.
And follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Pinterest at @dig_history. So we'll see you there. Bye. Why are you typing into your
whistle? Had to do
I think you're saying tuberculosis.
Oh yeah, how do you say it? It was at first published exclusively by the good dare.
Bed scenes.
You need to pause there.
Okay. And she slips away surrounded by loved ones. Too long.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.